Hi atop Spencer Hill, you're listening to The Baron, the voice of SUNY Corning. I'm Michael Clark.
My guest is Tom McGrath, who for 43 years was a professor of biology at SUNY Corning, where he taught college biology, genetics, and field courses, directed the college's honors program, and was the first professor in the State University of New York system to be awarded both the Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Teaching and the Chancellor's Award for Excellence in Scholarship and Professional Activity. As a researcher, he developed and served as principal investigator for the long-running Bohemian Reef Survey, sponsored by the Earthwatch Institute. He and his wife moved to St. Petersburg, Florida in 2010, and they have been exploring the Everglades and Florida's other ecosystems ever since. And most recently, he published his third novel, Wild, A New Normal. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Congratulations on the new book.
Thank you very much. We're delighted.
Give us a synopsis of Wild, A New Normal.
The story revolves around a small town in a rural setting, with a community college located on a hill outside of the town, surrounded by farms and open country. It involves the process called rewilding. It starts off with one of the professors at the college walking back to his car, sort of after dark, not late at night, but, after dark. And he runs across something that he ultimately defines to people who interview him as a dinosaur-like deer. It turns out to be an elk, which hasn't been seen in the area for a century or a century and a half. It had been extirpated by hunting and by habitat loss, etc. And as the story progresses, it turns out that the elk is not alone, and it turns out to be a breeding population in the area. And in fact, other animals are beginning to move back into the area as well. Some by accident, some, I wouldn't say by design, but they are at least allowed to stay once they get there, or they make themselves available to stay once they get there. And therefore, the entire environment, both the college and its surrounding area, the town, the farms, and obviously the people, are taken back to a place with the environment in a state that they haven't seen for 100, 150 years. So this is essentially a process called rewilding. It started with a name like that in the United Kingdom, where they took unused farmland that they weren't farming any longer simply because they were importing more of their food from the EU. And they would let it go, and organisms would move back in and recreate an environment that was much more similar to what the environment had been 100, 150 years ago than it is today. And it would take away some of the human engineering that's gone on. So this rewilding has gone on all over. Probably the most notable in the United States, was Yellowstone National Park. When they actually introduced wolves, which were a keystone predator there, the entire environment changed in ways they had not expected. It actually changed ultimately, not just the immediate organisms and environment for the wolves, but ultimately changed the geology of Yellowstone, because in fact, beavers moved back and other animals that use their environment moved back in, and it changed the flow of streams and the fundamental geographic layout of the park. So it's rewilded in a very unique way.
Rewilding can occur with man's intervention, but it also can occur naturally.
Yes, it can. In fact, in the case of both Yellowstone and here, in my novel, it's a bit of both. There's some both human-engineered rewilding and natural rewilding. Now, we have a very bad track record as humans of trying to engineer ecology. And it turns out that the less you could do, the better. You're never going to get it back to exactly what it was, because things don't work that way in nature. They change, and they can go in that direction, but they'll never be exactly what it was 150, 200 years ago. But it will look vastly different and be much more stable.
In the Corning area, we've seen an influx of different species over the last 10, 15, 20 years. Coyote have moved back. Fisher have moved back. We have eagles. We have osprey. Talk to me about that. How does that happen?
It's a very natural process. For instance, when we first got to Corning, there were no coyotes, there were no eagles, there were occasional osprey on the river, but very rarely. The turkeys were not there. As it turns out, believe it or not, birds like the cardinal had only recently come into the area. They were considered a southern bird. They had started moving their geographic range north, and had, within the 20th century moved to upstate New York. So, I mean, it's a natural process. The animals that were sort of shot out, like elk, bison, fisher, wolves, eagle, with eagle and osprey were probably a product of DDT pollution. If there is a breeding population close enough and a corridor through which they can travel to get to a place, they will move there. They'll expand their range when they can, or even when they have to, or they're chased out of places where they are currently. And I think that's what you've been seeing. I know the New York State Fish and Wildlife tell you constantly that there are no cougars, for instance, in upstate New York. And yet you see pictures on the internet all the time of people with cougars in their backyard. Well, what they fail to tell you is, yes, there are cougars in New York. They are not a breeding population that is going to change the environment at this point. Can they get to that point? Quite possibly, if they're given the right chance to do so. You know, it's just a natural process.
Another example I'm aware of is in New York City, the introduction of peregrine falcons to control the pigeon population.
Absolutely. Yeah, that worked out marginally well. there are peregrine cameras that you can go to where they actually have cameras set up on the nests, on the buildings in New York. And you can actually, I think most of them are on YouTube. You can do peregrine nest watch. And believe it or not, peregrines have actually come back to your area. They were normal in the area. But there are recent reports of nesting peregrine falcons in Taconic Falls State Park. And I think in Letchworth State Park as well. So they're beginning to come back to you. And haven't been there again since at least the 1930s.
That's good news. Let's get back to your book. What inspired you as a biology professor and a researcher to start writing novels?
One of the things that struck me as I continued to read and think about things in my field, and also my teaching experience, was that the folks who were reading the kinds of mostly nonfiction books about ecological issues that I write about, such as habitat destruction, plastic pollution in the ocean, environments where exotic species are introduced, or the exotic pet trade, people who read books about that tend to be folks who already know a fair amount about that. They're already interested in the topic, and they get their perspective and points of view reconfirmed, and they may gain a fair amount of information in those books too. But those books tend not to be read by people who are on the fringes, may not know much about this at all, may not think about it ever, and may not believe it's real when they hear something about it. I thought novelizing these ideas and these issues could in fact draw people in who would not otherwise confront these issues. So what I wanted to write were books that were filled with quirky characters, fun, sometimes humorous situations, sort of gonzo activities out there that they might be drawn into, and some adventure. People read adventure. They read funny books. They read things that are just kind of out there and unique. And I thought I could slip in enough of the science and enough of the ecology and enough of the biology to really maybe surprise people. And I come to that from my teaching, because one of the joys I had with teaching was getting students who were taking a class that they felt they had to take. It was a requirement. They just wanted to get it out of the way. And somewhere along the way, the eyes widened, the smile came across their face, and they said, "This is fun. I like this." And, you know, it was an awakening kind of idea. And so for me, trying to do this in novelized form is exactly that, taking a form that's approachable to a much wider audience than most of the books about these subjects.
Any movie deals in the foreseeable future?
I would love it. Bring them on. I've had several of my readers have actually said my first book, The Corridor, reminded them of essentially a movie. Anybody who wants to look at it and, you know, shop it out to some producers, I'm all for it.
I can see Harrison Ford in the role.
He's too old.
In your book, you've included recipes this time. Tell me more about that.
Well, it turns out that as I was writing, the characters in here, particularly those associated with the college, get together very often around food one way or another. And I started just putting it in because when we were at CCC, we often did the same thing. We had lots of entertaining times when we would get together with people, both at the college and in the community. But it was usually around dinner or around, you know, some sort of food event. And we always tried to, I wouldn't say outdo each other, but at least bring something unique and new to the table each time. So I put this in the novel. And my wife, Laura, said, "You know, you put in real foods that we eat and we love. We could put recipes in here." And I said, "Well, why not?" So, you know, we've got recipes in there that are Afghan, Greek, Indian, you know, Italian, you name it. And they're recipes that we've tried and found really interesting and fun and tasty. And they're in the narrative of the novel as well as in recipes at the end.
Very nice. As a biologist, I assume Spencer Crest has a very special place in your heart.
It certainly does. I was there basically at its beginnings. When I first got to the college, two biology teachers, John Brennan and Jack Wills, had marshaled students to build some trails in the back area, which is now part of Spencer Crest Nature Center and the college. And ultimately, Jack Wills got involved with Corning Rotary, and they sponsored this business of turning it into a college and community nature center that served the entire region. And, you know, I was involved in that pretty much throughout the entire process, not as heavily as those two were. But then they brought in a special architect to build the building. And when the building and the trails were finished, they brought in John Denver to actually dedicate the nature center. And we were part of all of that business. And we used it extensively in the biology program at Corning, too. Now, I know your listeners can't see this, but I'm going to show you the book cover of my latest novel. And that is Spencer Crest Nature Center's pond, Amelia Pond. Now, you'll notice that there's an elk on the cover. That elk wasn't there when I took that picture, by the way. but yes, I mean, it has a very special place in our hearts. And you know, our kids loved the fact that they could grow up in the wilds there.
For those who are not knowledgeable of Spencer Crest and the trails, what would you see if you went wandering through the trails and just looked around as far as the environment is concerned?
What you're going to see is a mixed hardwood northeastern deciduous forest primarily. Now, there is open meadow for sure, but that has been actually managed a little more than the forest itself. Some of the forest has been managed a little bit, but for the most part, it has been left. Now, it's also a second growth forest. Within the first 150 years of settling the area, the forest was actually clear cut. So what's growing there now is actually a second growth. It's not native, the original virgin native forest. But you will find a huge variety of plants and animals there that are typical of that northeastern deciduous forest. And it's kind of on a cusp. There's actually a range of forest in the northeast. If you go a little further north, you run into a forest that is primarily birch, beech, and maple. And if you go a little further south, you run into a forest that is mostly oak, hickory, and hemlock. And it turns out that Corning area and Spencer Crest is on the cusp of both of those. So you'll see both types of vegetation, the understory, and the organisms that go with it at the Nature Center.
Students from different areas, I'm thinking New York City, who now come to college at Corning, are amazed by the nature and sometimes a little freaked out about seeing deer on campus or even bear. How many bear are in that area?
Quite a few. It turns out that, and I don't know when the last time was, but there have always been the possibility of bear coming on campus at any time. And we have had them. Actually, the incident with the elk that I start my novel Wild with was actually an incident with a bear that one of our faculty members ran into on his way to his car. And so they are there. We have friends that live in the community just near the college there. And they see bear, actually, they've been seeing bear all winter. It looks like they may not have even hibernated this year. They see them on average 2-3 times a week. So they'll just wander through there. They have a fairly large range that they travel through. But we used to have bear patrols where buildings and grounds people would actually parole the outside, patrol the outside of the campus looking for bears so that they could chase them away before class changes.
Your previous books, The Corridor and Just One Word, are about ecology and biology as well. Can you just give me a brief synopsis on both of those?
Sure. The Corridor is set in the Everglades, and the title comes from the concept of wildlife corridors that are really important for maintaining good connection among populations and preventing isolation, genetic isolation, which leads to some very bad things for wildlife. Florida has been creating wildlife corridor for probably about 15 years. A man named by the name of Carlton Ward has been working very hard to set up corridors from the tip of the Everglades all the way to the Georgia border, and from the East Coast all the way across the Panhandle and into Mississippi and Alabama. And these are essentially areas that are connected wild spaces where animals can travel. Well, the corridor is actually set in the Everglades, but it has the potential to expand from there because of the corridor. And it's based on an invasive species. Now, the invasive species everybody probably knows about are pythons. This is not a python or a group of pythons. I'm not going to give it away. It's kind of special, but it's a real adventure. And I think you'll be amazed at some of the information that's in there because it's based on the exotic pet trade. And there are many exotic pets, people that keep things as exotic pets. And there are many of those species in people's homes than there are in the wild at this point. So that kind of thing can happen. And that book is a real adventure. Just One Word is based on our work on San Salvador, Bahamas, and the coral reef work we were doing. Many of the characters are people we know and have given a nice send-up to in this book. But essentially, this one is about ocean pollution, and I don't mind giving this one away. The Just One Word, the quote comes from the movie The Graduate, and it is plastics. And the ocean plastics are much worse than most people even believe out there. And this book takes it under advisement as to what's out there and what some of the impacts might be or are now already known and what they may be in the future, what the thoughts are for potential remediation. On the other hand, I will say it's a funny book. And the characters are quirky as all get out. There's a little Carl Hyacinth-esqueness about it. And I hope it really brings people in so that they can then confront the sort of downside of the book in a more positive way.
Environmental issues are in the news more so now than they have been in the past due to forest fires, tornadoes when tornadoes aren't supposed to be happening, hurricanes, floods. There are so many environmental issues right now created by man. Is there hope for our planet?
Many, many people believe there is. I will say this. The planet and a form of nature will survive. Nature perseveres and prevails. It may not look anything like what we have ever thought nature was or what we've experienced it being in our lifetime. But no matter what we do to it, we're sort of passing through. So the planet itself will be okay. All of the things that we think we have been given stewardship over, probably not. Things will be vastly different from my perspective. And when you say humans have created it, I think the thing that strikes me is that we are more and more getting populations of people moving toward lifestyles like our own, rather than remaining poor all their lives. Still a lot of way too many people in that situation. But that means an incredible use of resources. And those resources are essentially mined from the environment. They aren't really replaced and they're not sustainable. And what's happened when I first remember, back in, middle school or high school, looking at the human population, it was about 2.5 billion people. And now it's over 8 billion people. And that's in my lifetime. The rate at which population has exploded, I mean, it actually is faster than was predicted by those folks who were predicting it back in the 60s and 70s. Since we're moving into a more sort of Western lifestyle way of living for more and more people, that means more mining of the environment rather than creating sustainable ways of using it. Now, that said, I think people are making valiant efforts to do the latter, and I certainly hope that they have the ability to make efforts and inroads that I'm not as positive about happening as many other people.
What might be the most important change that we as a human race could make, in your opinion?
I think it would all stem from understanding how tied our lives are to every other living thing on the planet. And every other living thing is then tied to the geology and the environment, the physical environment. If we somehow were able to get people to understand that unity that is absolutely allowing us to be here, it might have people think two or three times before they continue to act in unsustainable ways. So connection with the natural world, connection with the physical world in ways that we're not used to connecting at this point.
Which is very similar to your stories that you've written.
Exactly.
You spent 43 years in the Corning area, 43 years at SUNY Corning. That's a long time for any career, especially in education. What kept you going for all those years?
Oh, so many things. I every career you run into situations and conditions that, you wish weren't there. But for the most part, I would say I just had a ball. I had a wonderful time. I had wonderful colleagues for the most part. I just really enjoyed my students. I had wonderful interactions in the community. We had great things to do there. It was a wonderful place to raise kids. We were close to nature. We could get out in it at any time we wanted. I mean, you walk out your door and you're basically there. We just, we had a fantastic time. Now, in terms of the career, teaching was something that it surprised me in some ways. When I told you before about the light in the eyes coming on, that kept me going no matter what. Now, I tried to reinvent myself as I went through too, because as you pointed out, I taught general biology, I taught genetics, I taught field courses. I was also part of the honors program, so that took me into a much broader field. I got involved with the theater program at the college, so I directed plays and helped with the theater kinds of stuff. Then I got involved in my research. And I could bring my research into the classroom and into the community and into the broader broader culture. And all of that kept me going, not only kept me going, just kept me very very excited about almost every day. So it was easy to stay engaged and very happy with what I was doing for those 43 years.
It's educators like you that make a difference in students' lives. And I appreciate that. And I'm sure all your previous students appreciate that as well. Tom, it's certainly been a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed the time.
I'm Michael Clark. You've been listening to The Baron, the voice of SUNY Corning.